Hello, everybody, and welcome to New Books in Psychoanalysis. I am Anna Fishson, your host, and today it's my pleasure to be speaking with Alenka Zupančič about her recent book, What is Sex?, published by MIT Press 2017. First, I'll briefly introduce her. Dr. Zupančič is a Slovene philosopher and social theorist. She received her PhD from the University of Ljubljana and from the University of Paris 8. She works as research advisor at the Institute of Philosophy, which is part of the Scientific Research Center of the Slovene Academy of Sciences, and is professor at the graduate school there, as well as the European Graduate School. Together with Slavoj Žižek and Mladen Dolar, Alenka is one of the most prominent members of the Ljubljana School of Psychoanalysis. She's one of the Slovenian Troika, as I like to call them. She's notable for her work on the intersection of philosophy and psychoanalysis, as well as her original theory of comedy, on the topic of which I had the pleasure of hearing her give a lecture at Duke University in about maybe 2015. I don't know if you remember that one, but her books have been translated into many languages, and her most recent work deals with the relationship between sexuality and ontology, as we'll discuss shortly. In addition to the book we'll be talking about today, Dr. Zupančič is the author of The Odd One In on Comedy by MIT Press, 2008, Why Psychoanalysis, Three Interventions, NSU Press, 2008, The Shortest Shadow, Nietzsche's Philosophy of the Two by the MIT Press, from 2003, and finally, Ethics of the Real, Kant and Lacan, published by Verso in 2000 and 2011. Alenka, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, Anna, for this exhaustive introduction. I'm really pleased and happy to be here and to have this opportunity to discuss my book here with you today. And yes, I do remember this occasion at Duke. Yes, I do.
Okay.
I was speaking on comedy then and working on this subject.
Yes, yes. It's my pleasure to have you on. Okay, so let's begin with some biography. Please tell us a bit about yourself, specifically, you know, what led you to psychoanalysis and then to writing a book about the meaning of sex.
I kind of discovered psychoanalysis rather soon in my life. I was still in high school when I started reading some Freud's text and also some first translations of Lacan, which already appeared then in Slovenia. There was a very lively intellectual scene also at that time in the 80s, which was very much inspired not only by Lacan, but very much by him and some other important figures of the French contemporary philosophy and psychoanalysis. So I was somehow caught into this vortex of ideas that were to some extent or to a large extent related to psychoanalysis. And this was precisely, I mean, my question at that time was, what did all these people that were talking about psychoanalysis study? And the answer then was philosophy, because there was no other way to get in touch even with some of these ideas. So I decided at that point that I would study philosophy, but my studying philosophy was always very much influenced or curved by the fact that Lacan and Freud and some others were kind of a central references of my work and of my studies. So it was in this sense, although I did study philosophy both in Ljubljana and in Paris, it was always with people who were also, let's say, good authorities on psychoanalysis, at least from this theoretical, of course, point of view. So I was working with both all the time. So I have some clinical experience, but this was like, let's say, for private purposes. I was in analysis for some years, but this was never meant to be something like a psychoanalytic training. So I have some experience, but I don't think this is even very much of a relevance here. What is perhaps of relevance is the fact that I've always considered that psychoanalysis, as discovered by Freud and then kind of led forward by Lacan, was an event that also to some extent happened to philosophy, namely in the sense that philosophy cannot simply go on as if nothing happened here, that there was something in relationship also to some fundamental philosophical interrogations that could not be simply or should not be simply overlooked. This was very much my conviction.
Mm-hmm. And you participated in reading groups or you went to lectures? Was there a kind of...
Yes, of course. I mean, all kinds of lectures, reading groups. I mean, in Slovenia, there were not so many lectures, actually. I kept meeting with people who were part of this circle. So we would meet and discuss things. In Paris, of course, I went to also to many, many, many lectures in psychoanalysis, not only in philosophy. So because there is this open access to the intellectual landscape that was there also still when I was there. So it's... I did hear a lot of things, and of course, yeah, as I said, I read a lot of things, I studied, I discussed them in this sense, yeah.
Mm-hmm. So fast forward a little bit to the writing of the book. What inspired the book about the meaning of sex, which is quite fundamental to, I mean, I realize that it's fundamental to everything Lacan certainly ever said. So please tell
us. I definitely think that it is probably the most fundamental question or issue in psychoanalysis. And this is precisely how I approached it. And this is also why I really took time in writing this book. I mean, I was working on this theme, on this question, roughly for 10 years. I did other things at the same time, but I did not want to rush things too much here because I really thought that there are some fundamental issues, particularly concerning also the relationship between philosophy and ontological interrogation and psychoanalysis and its way of interrogating these things that were at stake. And that so it was the more I did write a lot on psychoanalysis and philosophy before, and I did notice that to some extent also in other books, in Ethics of the Real, in the book on Nietzsche and on comedy, I kept returning or circling around certain fundamental questions that I somehow briefly addressed there, but not to my complete satisfaction, so to say. That there were some really fundamental questions that remained open. And I think this book is actually an attempt to kind of supply at least some of these answers, conceptualizations of these fundamental questions. And perhaps part of this is that for me, sexuality, as conceived by psychoanalysis or as it functions in psychoanalysis, is not simply some descriptive name of some naughty practices or something like this, but is a concept. And it is a concept that formulates, I would say, a certain persisting contradiction of reality, of our reality. And this is where its interests come from. It's not simply that it is more or less funny, juicy details about our life. It is also, I think, if we simply start talking about sexuality on this level of describing some things, we never get nowhere, because then you have all hundreds of these kind of questions that keep popping up. But what exactly is this already sex or not? Is cigar only a cigar or is it? I mean, immediately you get pulled into some kind of proliferation of undecidability. But then you have to, I think, turn this around and say this is precisely because sexuality itself constantly negotiates some undecidability. So in this way, I kind of turned the tables around and really started interrogating sexuality as an ontological problem. That is to say, as a problem in psychoanalysis, that it is not simply a problem of doing, but a problem of as I said before, a fundamental contradiction of our reality that gets articulated only or particularly through sexuality, through what we perceive as sexuality in its link with the unconscious.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, you kind of answered my next question, which was going to be, you know, but maybe you can elaborate what sex is for you. Moving from the idea that, or getting deeper into this idea that it is an ontological impasse or problem. And also, you know, from that too, what if anything does it have to do, if anything, I mean, yeah, with your conception with genital or infantile sexuality? Because in the book, I should say this too, that, and it should be pretty clear maybe by now, there are no body parts or pleasurable acts in the book. If you're going there for penises, vaginas, breasts, you know, it's like nothing. So, but
there are some breasts.
There's a little bit of
they discuss Christianity and partial object that proliferate there, but not in that sense. No.
That's, I don't want to, I exaggerated slightly. but I, you know, I think it's still important to maybe theorize the relationship between the sex that you're talking about and this more kind of pedestrian or, you know, quotidian understanding of sex. So maybe you can say a little bit more and kind of talk about what it does have, if anything, to do with human sexuality as we normally think about it.
Yes, no, what you just pointed out is absolutely crucial. And this also came up in some of the discussions that I already had in relationship to this book. I remembered at some point somebody said, but in this way, you take all the fun out of sex. But precisely, this is the achievement. I mean, this is the kind of, I'm proud of this achievement precisely because not, and I'm not saying that we shouldn't have fun having sex, but this is not about this. This is precisely about if you kind of tackle this from the psychoanalytic point of view, what needs a certain interrogation is precisely how we, how this kind of satisfaction and fun that we can have pulls us into a certain logic, with or without our will or consent. So, but what happens here in my investigation, in my inquiry, is actually something rather different. It is a kind of very much as it is already in Lacan, about formulas, about things like this. And I just remembered something that I think even I mentioned in the book, that also Alain Badiou, when he was explaining some of these Lacanian notions and the notion of love, and he also used all these formulas. And afterwards, a journalist wrote a report of this lecture, and he said that this is just, this took all the juicy, fleshy part away from love, from sexuality, and that probably Badiou, when he makes love to a woman, he doesn't say to her, I love you, like je t'aime, but je te m'attends, which would be I formalize you, or something like this. Kind of a funny wordplay. I threw matem. This really works in French. But anyway, this is very much part of, I think, what is there already in Lacan. It is not there. This psychoanalytic theory is not there so that we would enjoy sex some more. It is not sexology. It is not. These are not advices about how to get more fun out of it. It really tackles some of tries to define the configuration which defines us in this, on this level, the level of sexuality. And now if I return to the other part of your question, why I think what I said before, that that sexuality is about all a concept of a certain contradiction of reality, we can, for instance, say that there, if there is on one level, there is the what we call signifying order, or simply language, or speech, or discourse, as this kind of symbolic network. But then there is also on the other side, and inseparable from it, there is this enjoyment, this jouissance, this what Lacan calls surplus enjoyment. Precisely, it is always surplus. It is always too much. It is never just the right measure, like pleasure. It is always something that goes a little bit beyond. But it is enjoyment. It is and it is not signifying. It is not in the sense. It is not symbolic. But at the same time, it is inseparable from the symbolic. And I would, perhaps one of the simplest definition of sexuality is precisely that sexuality is what kind of configures together these two things which are heterogeneous and inseparable at the same time. Surplus enjoyment and the signifying structure. Sex is never simply about purely bodily enjoyment, because all these even parts of bodily enjoyment are usually already included into some signifying network which allows them to gain their autonomy. For instance, very often there is a pleasure, but for this pleasure to become this really independent, autonomous, self-seeking activity, like in the case of the drive, there is a certain signifying support there, even if this support is the support in what I call a signifying minus or lack. But there is an armature which even only allows for these pleasures to really explode into something which is not simply pleasure, but which is this kind of excessive jouissance that psychoanalysis also discovered at the very heart of human existence.
And it is this discomfort, if you will, or this this maybe gap or inability to name or something like this, that then maybe, would you say, is it covered over by our concept of sexuality, the more pedestrian kind that we're more familiar with? Is this basically masking the fact that there is this unnameable or uncomfortable, not quite pleasurable but enjoyable rupture or fissure?
This is definitely one thing that gets persistently covered in this usage is precisely the element that does not completely fit in any kind of relational configuration. And this is also why, as you know, one way of putting this in Lacanian terminology, what is kind of wrong here is this famous formula, there is no sexual relation, which means that simply there is no kind of obvious self-explanatory sexual binary. We would have like something that would go on like or fit each other like a key and a keyhole or something like this, and that this would then account for sexual relations. No, our relations, as far as they involve sexuality, are precisely defined by the fact that this does not exist, which does not mean that we don't have relationships. Obviously, we do have relationships, but these relationships are already predicated upon or founded upon this very lack of this direct complementarity or relation. So this is why they always include, to return to this previous discussion, a certain signifying armature where precisely the complementary signifier is missing, but at its place, this surplus enjoyment appears with which we also tackle. So this kind of how to make this square circle, so to say, function, this is precisely what relations are then very much about. But there is this, and this is also what this kind of negativity, the fact that there is no sexual relationship, so to say, is also what is very often covered up, as you put it, or obliterated by this usual, street level of speaking about it, which is basically means that if we just enumerate features of men and women, we can come so as far as to say, okay, but these relationships, they never work. But this is not what Lacan meant when he says there is no sexual relationship. He says no sexual relationship is precisely what configures the space within which, of course, there are relationships and some of them do work. I mean, it's not
right. Right. I do want to return to the non-relation or relationship, but first, I just kind of want to flesh out some things that you're even... Yes. Gesturing toward. You make the point in the book that in Lacan's theory, the real isn't simply something out there existing prior to language or external to language. Instead, the real is constituted with, this is really important, it's constituted with the signifier, as is the sexual. Mm-hmm. And you also explain that the signifier, this is, I love, enters the signified. So can you say something reassuring maybe to our Laplanchian materialist listeners or some? Does the enigmatic message have materiality? Does the unconscious have materiality? Are we going to just forego the material or do we? How do we grapple with it?
No, I think here I would have two answers on two different levels. One is the one that you mentioned, which I think is very, very, really crucial to point out, particularly since we even have in some early Lacan this idea of the real as something that is outside the language and that was lost, so to say, once the language appeared. And now we can only with some extreme experiences or ordeals kind of force our passage through to this real. So this is, I would say, this kind of a more traditional, also philosophically speaking, more traditional idea where language is conceived as a kind of a symbolic net that we put on the world, on the things, which then kind of get mediated through this language and disappear as the real thing that was once there behind. But then very early on, I guess already with this magistral definition of the signifier, Lacan actually changed this completely. Now, if you just take this famous formulation that signifier is what represents a subject for another signifier, this is really baffling. I mean, this reverses completely this idea that we spontaneously have the signifier is some symbolic sign, let's say a word, which represents a thing, an object or an idea for the subject. This is what we kind of tend to think. And here, this completely disappears. And the signifiers are not simply this representative net, but they are part of the word. They are not simply used to refer to the word. They are very much integral part of the word. And here, I would now suggest two ways in which we could understand this materiality of the signifier. One is following your conclusion also that there is this the real now becomes something which is the inherent impasse of the language itself. It is the point when the language itself breaks down, not because it cannot grasp some external real, but because it is itself ridden by a certain impossibility. The impossible is part of the language itself. It's not some external impossibility that language cannot get to. And in this way, then we have a very different concept of the real as precisely the, as also Lacan has these formulas like impasse of formalization, the impasse contradiction, something that is very much, this is why one needs to be so attentive to the point where in these linguistical structures or structure of speech or discourse, something happens. This, because this indicates not only that there is something else at stake, but also that there is a structural problem of the structure itself, which is being kind of revealed there. So there is, and in this sense, yes, I think that there is a certain materiality of the signifier. There is, I mean, I really like this Laplanchian idea of the enigmatic signifier, which I think it's a kind of a perfect concept precisely of a certain materiality of a signifier precisely there where there is no content, because this is part of the idea. It is the unconscious itself enters as something real with these enigmatic signifiers. It enters as, it's not that unconscious does not start with the first thing we repress. The idea there with these enigmatic signifiers that like we as kind of children get bombarded with is precisely that the unconscious is kind of invasive, that it kind of invades our space and comes with the, because with the structure of language that we hear speaking around us, we also inherit what in this very structure is missing or its own impasse. We don't simply inherit all that is there. We also inherit something that is not there and that this structure kind of revolves around all the time. So this would be my reading of this, what is the unconscious is out there in the sense that there is a certain level of repression that is already operative on the level of the structure of the speech of language itself. Yeah, so, but this question of the materiality of the signifier also has another dimension, I think, which is very much a part of our, of the discussions that are recently going on in, not only in philosophy, but also in science and so on. Namely, we could ask ourselves, how does it relate to what we are hearing today about this notion of Anthropocene? Because if you think about what exactly is Anthropocene, it is defined as an epoch where man has become a geological factor. But man or humanity is a very kind of loose term. And I think a very much more precise way of putting it would be to say that Anthropocene is the point where discourse or signifier becomes a geological factor. Because it is not simply by our human existence that something like the whole ecosystem could be really changed to such an extent, or that even geologically it makes sense of speaking of some of this difference, but precisely because signifiers and how we work with them, how science works with them, have consequences, direct consequences in the real. And I don't know, Lacan had this example of man landing on the moon simply based on certain calculus and formula that were manipulated in the right way, which is actually a very good example, I think, of how signifier is not simply representative. It can bring us to the moon to some extent, which is a kind of epochal event in itself. And in this sense, also the whole theory which Lacan has of science is precisely that it is not simply about the real world outside. It is the formulas are directly kind of manipulating the real outside. And I think this is important because very often also in philosophy today, there is this current that this new realism, which to put it in a very simple way, aims at supposedly breaking out of the discursive cage, as it is formulated. So we have this discourse, we are trapped into this cage, and we cannot get out of it to the real as it is, to the real world, and so on. But I think what this notion of Anthropocene shows is precisely that the discourse itself has already broken out of itself. It is always more than just a discourse in this simplified sense of understanding it. And I think this is precisely what Lacanian theory enables us to see, to grasp the discourse, the signifier, not simply as something that stands like facing the reality or the real, but something that is in a very paradoxical sense, but nevertheless very much part of this real or is able to touch it in some way.
This is, yeah, you have a lot to say in the book about the new materialism.
Yeah, there is a chapter which tell us what I'm now very briefly resuming in a much more detailed way. But I think I think this is an interesting question. I'm not dismissing it. I think it was very important that it was put on the table. But I also think that psychoanalysis has here some very interesting answer or approach, which precisely kind of interrupts this the opposition between nominalism and realism, and it kind of transposes this discussion in a much more interesting way. Yeah.
So I love your discussion of the human as unfinished animal, and this is in relation to what you were just saying, or it has some bearing on what you were saying. So I'm curious what you meant by this precisely. It's actually, and if it relates to one of your chapter subheadings, which was, you know, where do adults come from? So what precisely is in the human? I mean, this is the question here, that is less than animal. No, because I think the common assumption is that we have something in excess. But here you're making a very interesting point that it's actually that there's something unfinished about us as animals that creates our humanity.
Yes, I think there is a way in which one could turn around a little bit this more commonly told story about how humanity actually brings something more, or is this precisely excessive element in contrast to nature or animality and so on. And my point is here not simply to deny this, but to say that this excess is actually already a symptom of a certain minus, or of precisely the fact that we are not even fully animals. It is not that we are, first we are, the idea is that there is this kind of fundamental basis or of animality, and then the human is also something more than this animal, biological, however you call it, substance, which with language and so on becomes, develops some excessive or whatever creational dimension. But here the idea is precisely that, that the whole story of the human starts with, if to put it into this mythological perspective, perhaps with something, let's say one signifier gone missing from the nature, let's say. There is something that, and it is at that point that the whole machinery starts to run, that the signifiers only start to refer to each other via this gap, via this slack, via this, there is the very movement of the signifying chain can only run if there is no, there is the mapping does not happen in this kind of a supposedly natural, direct way, immediate way. So the fact that there is this kind of a disappearance or minus, which is not simply zero, it is something precisely less than zero, which actually accounts for the appearance of the whole story of the surplus and the excess, and that humanity is obviously very much into also. But that we should actually look or take these two levels at the same time and together as precisely one and the same thing, and not simply starting from this kind of a more Aristotelian approach, when we would say, okay, first we are animals, and then we are also something a little bit more, which is then human, and so on. Because I think another point related to this that I also make in the book is also that this leads us to another interesting idea, namely that man is not, or humans are not, simply the opposite of animals or nature, nor are we simply one of the animals, which is also this kind of a now very fashionable, modest claim, but we are just a different kind of animal. Yes, we are a different kind of animal, but we are a differently different kind of animal in the sense in which, this is at least strong philosophical claim that I make in the book, that humanity, with humanity, there is a certain contradiction of the nature itself, which starts to exist as such. Like humanity itself is the existence of the contradiction of the nature or animality itself. So there is this kind of a philosophical, ontological moves that says even animality or nature with the capital letters do not exist. This is why they are not the other of men. They are already inconsistent, inherent. It's not this idea that as opposed to ourselves, nature is this completely rational or natural system that perfectly functions, that has no inherent contradictions, just everything runs as it should. This is a completely erroneous idea that we often project from our perspective. So here the idea is rather that no, nature itself is already ridden by many contradictions and antagonisms, but they only become antagonisms or contradictions that we can actually see, address, speak about with humanity incarnating this very contradiction. Appearing at the very point of, so it is a animal which kind of embodies the very contradiction of being animal. So it is, or that brings forward the very contradiction of animality as such. This would be one way of putting it, that human animal is not one of the animals, nor the other of the animal. It is the animal that brings forth the very contradiction of animality as such, or nature. So this would be the kind of philosophical claim. And so again, the relationship between the two is more interesting than one being the other of the other, or simply this kind of idea of a close totality and then excess that comes on top of this totality. No, the excess only arrives because this totality never was a totality.
Well, how does this, to bring this back a little bit to a psychoanalytic position, explicitly psychoanalytic position, why, I mean, is this then, what is the unconscious then? Is this, in your thinking, also this minus, or one can say maybe it's both excess of meaning and minus? Why, and why furthermore is it always bound up with surplus enjoyment or set or with sex? Why, I mean, why call it, and furthermore, maybe this is like the third part three of the question, why call it sex and not say just enjoyment or a gap? Or, I mean, why insist on this kind of, on this signifier, you know, the sexual, yeah.
Sexual. Yeah, precisely because I think there is a difference between enjoyment or pleasure or bodily pleasure and sexuality. And this difference, and this brings us to the beginning of, I think, this interview, when I said that we are all the time like inhabiting or at the same time two things or dealing with two things. There is the signifying structure and there is the surplus enjoyment. And sexuality is not simply on the side of the surplus enjoyment. It is precisely what brings forward the inseparability of these two things, the symbolic order and the surplus enjoyment, in their very heterogeneity. So it is, and I think that, and this is precisely why I say that it kind of formulates this concept of sexuality in a psychoanalysis, formulates a certain contradiction of reality, because reality precisely is what is neither simply one nor the other. Reality cannot be reduced simply to the signifying chain, to the symbolic description, nor can be simply reduced to a kind of purely non-signifying bodily enjoyment, because this enjoyment, this surplus enjoyment already is or depends upon, or as I put it in the book, appears at the very place where something is lacking in this signifying structure. So this is the way how conceptually I kind of link the two, that enjoyment does not appear just anywhere. That structurally, the structural place in the other when where it appears is precisely this minus. And I think, moreover, this explains why in Lacan, why Lacan can insist that the other, this concept of the other, the with capital O, can be, he insists that it is both the other of enjoyment and the other of the signifying structure, which are for him always two heterogeneous things. But this is precisely the reason, because it is at the very point in the other where the signifier is lacking, enjoyment appears. So there is, at least this is how I kind of formulate this, there is a kind of topological coincidence of the signifying minus and of the surplus jouissance, which does not simply appear somewhere else, but is circulates precisely around this minus. And so if we try to separate these two, as it is often and very also fashionable today, and say, okay, let's not talk about sex, let's just talk about pleasures, body, or on the other hand, of course, about the symbolic order, about identity. This is very interesting because in this way you get to genders, to, you get to identities, but sexuality disappears. This is clearly what the move from sexual difference to gender differences is, clearly the move from sexuality, which as a signifier disappears in this plurality of identities. But I claim that these are two very different levels precisely because sex is not about identity. Sex is about precisely what disrupts our identity, what makes it impossible to have any kind of, kind of sexual identity. I think is perhaps even kind of a contradiction in terms, because it is kind of, it, sex precisely tackles the point where two things which are in principle incompatible, like the signifying structure and the enjoyment, appear in one in one object or in one signal, in one form. And this is precisely when why it does not why articulates together these two things. And yeah, now this brings me back to the first part of your question, which was about the unconscious, which for me is precisely part of the signifying structure as such. And here, I don't know if this is not too technical, perhaps, but you know that there is in Freud, there is this hypothesis that he introduces at some point, hypothesis of a primal repression. That is to say that before there is any repression in the usual sense of the word, there is already some repression going on. And so how to understand this? And Lacan actually read this precisely in this sense, that there is a certain repression that is pertaining to the signifying structure as such, and that invades us, so to say, with the speech of the others, which is not necessarily our, this is not our unconscious, but it is also our conscious. It's not that our unconscious can be so simply separated from this structural gap or minus, which is the kind of the unconscious that is already out there, not as some kind of a positive archetypal unconscious, but as a gap, as a minus, as something which kind of attracts, so to say, further repression as well. So, and where subject finds a kind of topological structure that fits repression as such. So, and the point, in all this is that sexuality is precisely the concept that relates in psychoanalysis this question of the unconscious, of the signifying structure and so on, of this structural minus or impasse to the question of the surplus enjoyment, to the question of pleasure, to the question of precisely as the sexuality means that they are ontologically in the very non-relation that is theirs, absolutely, there is no relation, but at the same time, they coincide at the same topological place. So they're one and the same, but at the same time, completely different. And this is the very core, let's say, of the issue and of the problem. And the attempt to separate them neatly was, if we look at this from this perspective, for instance, I discussed at some point at the book, the whole way in which Christianity goes about it, it is precisely not at all as we sometimes think that Christianity goes against this polymorph or perverse pleasure subject. No, it doesn't go against it. Corporality and corporal pleasures are very much part of a Christian imaginary and doctrine. What is absolutely forbidden is the link of this whatever bodily martyrly object with sexuality. So we can have as for instance, this is also what happens very often when we speak of the Freudian concept of infantile sexuality. The question there is, okay, we can understand that a child who kind of switches from enjoying food to sucking its tongue did kind of accomplish certain kind of automatization of a pleasure, which is now embodied in this gesture of sucking the thumb or something else. And then, of course, but why would this be sexual? Why this is simply a pleasure, but it has nothing to do with sex. It has nothing to do with sex if we understand sex in the meaning of a sexual relationship. But it has all to do with the sex if we understand sex as partly pertaining precisely also to the signifying structure that made this shift from enjoying the food to enjoying just the sucking of the tongue possible. And precisely this is the claim that that already Lacan makes very clearly. In this passage to the autonomy of the pleasure, what happened in between is precisely the intervention of the signifier, which enabled, first of all, the demand to be separated from the need, but then also this kind of additional self-perpetuating activity becomes possible because it is already part of a certain, even if the child does not yet speak, or but it already kind of bats in this discursive.
It can be conjured.
Yes, precisely. And so, to say that children are sexual beings does not mean that they want to have sex. Obviously not. Freud did not claim anything like this. What he said is simply that there is no way in which we could simply say that sexuality originates in our, let's say, urge or imperative to reproduce and have children, which would be then what the explanation of the sexual drive. It does not happen like this. It happens much sooner, before even any sexual organs are mature or before we have any kind of... I think I lost you again.
No, I have you.
Uh-huh, okay, because my screensaver appears. Okay. So this is part of the... This was always what was, I think... Very problematic in the Freudian notion of infantile sexuality was not simply the idea that children enjoy, but that this enjoyment would have anything to do with what we otherwise call sexuality. This was always the traumatic point. And I think it still is. And there are some contemporary theories and philosophies and which kind of try and insist on this, that why call this sex? I mean, Foucault, again, is one of these prominent philosophers who kind of claimed that surplus enjoyment was, of course, not the scandal. This was the kind of, it was the scandal. The sex was not the scandal, but the sex was already a kind of pacification of the scandal involved in surplus enjoyment. So how biopolitical move, you have the enjoyment, which are in itself kind of subversive, and then you associate them with sex, and now they become part of this biopolitical control of sexuality and so on. But I think here something really gets lost if we make this move, because the question is, for me also, why does sexuality demand this regulation, this constant occupation with itself, which is clearly there, just a constant regulation. Why? Because we usually think that we know, because it is sexuality. No, but why? I mean, and this is precisely what I want to go into in my book, to insist on this question that we very often take this ban on sexuality to be self-explanatory. Yes, of course, it's a ban because it's sexuality. No, but why? I mean, and here it only becomes, if we dig a little bit deeper into this question, it becomes clear that what all these regulations of sexuality, all these prohibitions and ritualization of it are all about or about to hide or obfuscate is not simply something there is there in the sexual in display on it, like sexual organs or some debauchery of whatever kind, but some much more problematic ontological scandal, namely they mask something which is not there, something in sexuality which is not there, and which, if it were there, would make everything much simpler and more transparent, so to say. But I think this is a very interesting question, precisely how to, if from this point of view, one then looks at some of these obsessions, regulations of also, of course, feminine sexuality and so on, which always try to hide, again, to put it like this, not simply something that would be disturbing in itself, but precisely something which is disturbing because it is not there in what we see. Yeah, let's say there is this image of naked bodies. We could say, why do we need to cover them? Is it because we need to cover them because of something that we don't see when we see this image of the naked bodies, men and women standing together? And what we don't see in this image is precisely, we could say, the sexual relation. We don't see this. We see what is so scandalous about. I mean, this is a very interesting question. And as you know, I... I found this very nice story about the Adam's navel and this what needs to be covered on top of the sexual organs. So because I really think if one goes into some research here, one finds very interesting things about what really is disturbing in sexuality.
I heard an analyst say again last week, and I hear this every few weeks, it seems, that neurotics, especially hysterics, have all but disappeared, you know, from consulting rooms. And we mostly treat like borderlines now, narcissists. And I'm not sure what is happening here, you know, if we're now calling hysterics borderline, or it's that certain character disorders are more common today. But my thought is this, that we, and by we, I mean, maybe Lacanians, I don't know. We know that hysterics are the ones who demonstrate the non-coincidence of truth and knowledge, that they know about the desire of the other, masquerade, you know, precisely bisexuality. They ask these ontological questions. So maybe this is, I'm thinking like, what would you make of this erasure of the hysteric and her increasing pathologization? It strikes me that it's maybe precisely to cover this up again, that the hysteric kind of exposes some of these or at least asks the questions that would lead to such an exposure.
No, I think there is a very significant change or shift that is taking place and that you are describing. And I'm not completely sure whether this has to do with the way one listens or one practices psychoanalysis, or with some kind of a real change in the subjective structures, because I'm to some extent at least inclined to say that we kind of lost the ear for the hysteric, as I understood you suggesting also, in the sense of that, because hysterics or neurotics, this for me, it's not the same kind of clinical category as borderline, because borderline basically means everything else, or I mean, it's a very much, it does not have the same kind of a precision. And although, okay, perhaps I'm completely wrong, I'm not an analyst dealing directly with these things, but at least when it appeared, this notion, it was more or less describing all that different, the things that did not fit, so to say, some of the other categories.
At least at the beginning, right? At least at the beginning, it was a kind of, a broad category. Then there were Kernberg and others kind of made it more precise, but yes.
But then I'm sure that there is a certain kind of, that there is obviously very much the possibility that with the shifts and the change in social structures and in the way the social space operates, also the social space in general, and then of course also these other space, smaller spaces which are part of it, like families and so on, did change to such an extent to generate new subjective structures, and the borderline is an attempt to define one of these structures which functions in a very much different way than the hysteric did, or obsessional neurotics, and although I'm sure that at least obsessional neurotics still exist very much in these days. But you're right about the hysterics. It is very rare to hear this kind of hysteric voice, which was, on the other hand, the very origin of psychoanalysis. Was as if Freud could only hear this kind of voice. I mean, it was so, the hysterics was precisely the voice that woke him up from his dogmatic slander, to paraphrase this famous saying from what Kant said in relationship to Hume. So, it is interesting. And I think that definitely this also points to something which should be at least very obvious, namely that psychoanalysis is never simply a private affair. It always detects and is part of the certain very, very important shift in which our social, economic, and so on life is also changing, and how these interactions work, and in what they kind of force out of us, what is the position that they put us into, and so on. So it is not simply about any individual unconscious. It is always part. I mean, this was very much already there. The emphasis was already there in Freud. This is not simply a individual private affair, and this relationship to the other, to the symbolic order, to the social order, and so on, is a crucial part of any individual neurosis. Although then it can have some very individual particularities, but it is not, it is inseparable of a kind of a more symptoms of the social space as such. And so in this sense, I think there is probably a lot to say about how our contemporary social space and its pathologies, its symptoms are kind of pushing forward or indicating another kind of also kind of individual structures and pathologies, which precisely are not simply individuals, but are always correlated to the structure between they appear as well.
No, I was going to ask you about to link the political and sex and psychoanalysis, but I think you kind of just did that. You gestured toward that very much with your answer.
This is absolutely what I wanted to say, that there is something intrinsically political about the claims that psychoanalysis makes. It is not simply about the sexual as such, because, and this again brings us to the to one of the first question, namely the what is sex, what is this sexuality, why it is such an important point, such an important concept, because I think one could say, for instance, if Freud said where there is a problem, there is sex. This is one way of how we can read Freud. But the what is behind this assertion is not simply that, okay, sex is bad or lacking, so there is a problem. No. It is because sex is the very point where some ontological, or if you want, social problem or impasse is situated and played out. It names the very juncture of something which is wrong, so to say. And this is why it makes sense to look at these articulations, not because sex is some deeply intimate thing that then we'll enjoy looking into, but precisely because it is also always this kind of very sensitive point in which certain things, certain articulations which are extremely precarious take place, and many things can be seen and revealed because of this. And so sex is topologically, conceptually speaking, topologically situated at the precise point where something does not work completely. So, you know, there is, Lacan has this phrase, the speaking of the cause, which of course is also the cause of desire, that cause only exists there with where something does not work. You know, il y a de cause que dans ce qui cloche, which is a very nice way of formulating something similar, I think, to what I'm saying. I would say there is no sex que dans something which does not work. And this is not the same thing as to say that sex does not work. It is sexuality is precisely this kind of junction of this impossibility, and in this sense, it is not insignificant that psychoanalysis, looking at this juncture, was able to produce, suggest many very interesting things, not only about subjectivity, but also about the social, the political, and so on. So, and in this, because it's, one cannot see this kind of, let's say, fundamental antagonism from anywhere. One has to be situated at a specific point within this antagonism to be able to see it and to hear it. And I think here really the lesson of Freud also vis-a-vis the hysterics is really invaluable, because already to be able to not only to listen in this kind of a quasi-humanist sense, we need to listen to the others, but about all to hear something else that everybody hears when they listen to hysterics. I mean, because this was Freud. It's not simply that he listened to them. He heard something. He heard something else than was the and this something else then was a major breakthrough in a very very vast conceptual landscape. The concept of the unconscious. I mean, we think it's. Sometimes we forget that what is really revolutionary about it is not simply the fact that, okay, we are not conscious of some things. I mean, this is the concept of the unconscious that existed long before Freud. Of course, there are many things that we are not conscious of. But what Freud discovered with the concept of the unconscious is something very different. Is first of all that there is a lot of thinking going on, that this is a process, that it is a work, and that it is much more than simply the question of not being able to remember something or know something, but that something actively appears at this place, for instance, links things together. So it is a very, and this I think he really was able to hear, because he did not only listen to the hysterics, but he also heard what they were saying, and heard it precisely at this juncture, again, both of the social and individual, as well as on the junction of the other and the question of desire, which is obviously very much in the foreground of the hysterics, and the question of desire and its incompatibility with jouissance, precisely, which is again very much there for the hysterics. So this kind of aversion to this surplus enjoyment and preservation of the purity of this signifying structure of desire. So all this actually appeared there in a way that somebody needed to recognize it, and Freud did. And I think perhaps we still, I'm not sure if we really discovered any new subjective structure on such a fundamental level as that, but it can happen. And in this sense, to return to your previous question, I'm not saying that these clinical categories are simply the only one that are possible, far from it. So there probably will be new categories appearing.
Mm-hmm. I mean, when you were talking, I thought also about, since you mentioned Freud, I'm a psychoanalytic candidate, and like most, psychoanalytic candidates, I'm in analysis, and I therefore ponder and dread what I call the desert of the post-Oedipal. So in the book, you sort of address this, because I would like to know, what does sex or the sexual non-relation have to do with the goal of analysis? And also, what does post-analytic love look like? To go from sex to love, is it a love that is without suffering, without passion? You know, are we going to purify love? It's a similar question. Like, what about all the fun, pleasurable acts? So what this sex you're talking about is very pure, sort of formalistic. I guess I'm asking, is a non-symptomatic love relationship possible? Yeah.
No, I definitely think that, these are two levels. And I think that is this, the book that we are talking about is a philosophical book. And as such, I think it is also very interesting that to some extent we can say that sexuality is perhaps the philosophical problem or question of psychoanalysis, in this sense that it is here that both in this more contemporary way, certain metaphysical questions needed to be asked or casted out or whatever, but there is something there that kind of calls for this kind of attention. So yeah, this is in the interrogation here is, yeah, philosophical in this sense. But at the same time, no, when it comes to the question of the end of analysis, I think that first of all, there is this idea which I really much really support, which is that there is a certain shift that happens, as Lacan calls it somewhere, I think, in the very moorings of our being. So it is not simply We do change, to put it in a very simple way, but we do change in a way in which this very change becomes kind of not something that we can regret, but there is very often a problem when it comes in analysis to the point when, for this kind of shift to take place, one needs to almost let go of many, many things that at that precise point are your source of enjoyment or attachment and so on. So there is definitely this moment, or not simply moment, process in analysis that happens, that things that you enjoy at some point, you will probably no longer enjoy later on, let's say, like this, or not in this way. And this is interesting, because I like to use this example from Proust, Swoon in Love, because there is, I think, it's very nice way in which one can kind of illustrate what, for me at least, analysis is about. There is this scene when the hero is very much in love with Odette, but she no longer loves him. So he really suffers terribly, and he believes that he wants to be cured of this love, that he wants to be cease to be in love with her so as to escape this suffering that this unfortunate, unhappy love induces in him. But then he himself makes this kind of analysis and figures it out that he does not want to cease to be in love with her. He simply wants to this love to be returned so that he could remain the same. Because he says, and there is this really, really great sentence which Proust uses, and he says that in the depths of his morbid condition, this hero fears death itself more than such a recovery, such a getting cured of love, because he felt that this would be the death of what he now was, of all that he now was. This, I'm sorry, I'm quoting from memory, but something like this. So, but in I think this is precisely what at some point does happen in analysis, that it does lead to the death of many things that we are when we started. But at the same time, this perspective that there will be anybody on the other end regretting this loss, it's a kind of a false perspective. So it leads somewhere, but then I think that, yes, there is a possibility of fun or enjoyment, which is not pathological in this way, sense, that precisely does not support a certain perpetuation or certain pathological structure which necessitate, which are there because they are needed in order to perpetuate a certain repression, to put it very simply. Because usually what happens is that it is not simply that why is our enjoyment pathological. It is pathological not simply because it is bad for this or that, but because it is related to another issue. It is there because this is the only way for us to not, let's say, to maintain certain repression there. So, but this does not mean that then if this gets disentangled, I think that and this also brings us back to the previous discussion, this does not mean that this structure will simply fall apart and the enjoyment will no longer be possible. I think it will be possible, but in another way, which will not feel at the same time all these unconscious meanings of sexuality. I mean, which is another kind of obviously pleasure that we can draw from sexuality, all these sexual innuendos and the right kind of things that are kind of also a part of this. So, and I don't know, the question of the end of analysis is for me also a kind of political question, if you want to some extent, because obviously it is about possibility of, let's say, a pretty radical change, which nevertheless allows for, not only fun and enjoyment, but also probably for a certain kind of social tie. It is not simply that afterwards one explodes in some kind of individual monad which exists as a perfectly self-contained and satisfied with itself unit. I don't think this is the way one should look at it. And I just recently, I was asked in an interview if this is also, if the end of analysis is about giving up certain hope or certain expectations of certain illusions, that as if at the end we should be cured of certain. And I think this is a very interesting question, because the answer would be at the same time yes and no. It's clearly, at least for me, that psychoanalysis, it does not preach any kind of cynical wisdom, that now you know better than to hope for certain things because you know that they're impossible. For instance, this would be one very simple way of putting the end of analysis. Okay, I know this is impossible and now I'm no longer tormenting myself with it. But this is a kind of simply epistemological move when I think nothing happens in the moorings of our being if we just become disillusioned. I mean, this is not at all what happens. So I think what happens if we kind of play with this word of this notion of hope is rather something that goes in the other sense. That is to say that it is a certain shift that relieves us of hope. It is not, and that makes it possible to articulate what we hoped about in some other way. And I think that in this sense, this can be a condition in which we are only able to engage with the world and not simply with our personal hopes and expectations about this world. And I suggested this formula, but this is really very much biased by my both philosophical and political convictions, that I would say that at the end of the analysis, to some extent, the hope is replaced with courage. Courage to fight, to do, to kind of something different.
Wow. I like that very much.
Yeah, no, so, and the whole question of this post-Oedipal, there is always this double bind to this discussion of post-Oedipal, and we are very quickly, we get drawn into this kind of either kind of conservative regretting the good old times where fathers were still fathers and they knew how to make the children, I don't know. I mean, this kind of, you get also from psychoanalysts sometimes this kind of lamentations, good men, I mean, you need Oedipus to have real men, you need, or real, or whatever, which is obviously a gross simplification. And I don't know, and Lacan had this great line that if there was anybody who didn't have the Oedipus complex, it was Oedipus precisely because this is what, but okay, then he created it for the rest of the community.
But, right, that would make sense.
So it's there is, I mean, structures, as we were talking about them before, these social structures and economical structures, which are obviously part of this, are changing, and they are seriously changing, and they are changing because of this business as usual progress of certain, let's call it by their name, capitalist, democratic, liberal, neoliberal, whatever structures. But there are also things that happen and can more punctually affect these structures and induce certain kind of new symptoms or movements or whatever. So in this sense, it is obviously something that is going on, which is not simply, because the structure is not closed upon itself. But this for me is a good sign because it shows that as opposed to this image of neoliberal capitalism that we often also get as this kind of perfectly smoothly running machine that is able to cash in on or kind of assimilate every antagonistic excessive moment immediately and sell it off as just another surplus value. So whatever we do, there is nothing we can do. There is even the most subversive acts are immediately neutralized in some way or another. So there is this perspective. But at the same time, if we look at all these new symptoms, new pathologies, and I'm not speaking only of the individual ones, but only on the social level, on the level, if you want, also of general election and contradictions that that accompany all this, it is clear that contradictions are enormous and that they're very much ready to explode one moment or another. So it is this supposedly smooth running, it's not at all so smooth. So there are serious contradictions, and these points of contradictions are also the possible points of change and of shifting something. But then, of course, you are obviously, we are already speaking of something else, of a kind of different level of political organization that is able to kind of take these contradictions and make something productive out of them, which is and not simply trying, hoping that anything, that everything will go to hell, which probably it will sooner or later. But I'm not saying this, that there are problems which we should just let the machine ruin itself and then we can start all over again. Perhaps there will be nothing to start all over again from. So I'm not hoping that immediately after the disaster something better appears. It could be even worse. I don't think so. We do need some idea, we do need some politics, and we do need, as in analysis, some intervention. I mean, analysis, obviously, it is about the subject that kind of figures it all out, but at the same kind, there is this feedback punctuation is absolutely needed in order for one to figure it out, what does one really want. And I think this is a dimension of psychoanalysis which is very precious. There is a very important political lesson also, because in this belief in democracy, there is this kind of belief that people know what they want. But I don't think that it is that appreciative of people to say, no, we don't know always what we want. But there are some political mechanisms and ideas that need to circulate that only make us know what we want. So that there is no this immediacy of our beliefs, of our feelings and so on, needs to be interrupted at some point for us to be able to realize what we really want. And instead of this, what we are getting is a kind of intensification of this immediacy. What I mean is that the whole ideology of, affects, feelings, and so on, is there precisely to make it impossible for this kind of a, I could also call it reflective distance to appear, to this space with, across which one can actually see, realize, and think about what one does want, kind of is no longer there, because we are supposed to immediately feel what we want. As if there is something that would guarantee that these feelings are in themselves most authentic, which are not necessary. They are not necessarily this. So it's so I think there is obviously one way of describing this post-Oedipal whatever structure without even mentioning the infamous name of Oedipus. It's precisely the fact that there is this alienation in the sense of something which we do not know and feel immediately, but which we do know, which is the truth of what we want. Nevertheless, this kind of non-immediate space of non-immediacy of this is disappearing. And this is another way also of putting this diagnosis that public space is disappearing in the sense that it's being replaced with simply screaming of the private affairs. I mean, we could say everything is public now. Of course, you can put it on Facebook, on Twitter, but this is not what public stage means. I mean, public stage means that there is a certain different level of discussion, and when you say something there, it has a completely different impact than if you say it in a private conversation. But now this difference is completely disappearing, and it's been so for quite some time. So something is happening in the social tissue which goes very much towards some kind of obviously false, but nevertheless, immediatization of our functioning. And this very much deprives us of certain liberty of deciding things about ourselves as well as about the social. And I think one of the things that one should really strive to win back is precisely this certain level of distance, of alienation, of non-immediacy within the social, within our feelings, within how we interact with others, and start with this supposition that we not necessarily know or understand or feel each other, but there is a certain space in between which should be able to enable the circulation of this misunderstanding, and then something can come out.
And the strangeness that results, and the recognition of strangeness.
Yes, precisely. And the strangeness is it's not simply, the strangeness is usually our own strangeness. I mean, this is also one of the big lessons, I think, of Lacan from the ethics of psychoanalysis, that this enjoyment that we hate so much in the other, you know, these usual racist remarks like the other, the food that they eat smells strangely, the way they have sex is very bizarre, they smell bad, and so on. This is always some kind of a strange way of enjoyment, but that actually what really bothers us, says Lacan, is not there, is the fact that their enjoyment is actually the same as ours. I mean, it is our own enjoyment that bothers us. It's not theirs. So, and if we don't come to some to terms with this enjoyment that kind of nexus us from within and not from this stranger, then this structure cannot be obviously not efficiently dismantled, and the stranger will always embody our own enjoyment and how we do not want to accept it and deal with it. Because this is another, of course, major lesson of psychoanalysis, that enjoyment is not simply something that everybody wants. As opposed to, let's say, pleasures, enjoyment defines precisely a certain point where we even most usually don't want to go. It is not something that surprises our us or makes us do things that we don't necessarily want to do, and so on. So it is not simply the notion of enjoyment is not simply this kind of hedonist notion, but it is something that goes also against, I mean, that from within undermines the very hedonistic idea that we all that we want is to enjoy. You know, all that we want is to have pleasure, but to enjoy is something more, and it goes far beyond, yeah. Very often, far beyond the pleasure principle. So,
okay, Alenka, we've run out of time, unfortunately. Thank you, Alenka. It was great having you on, and I've been speaking with Alenka Zupančič about her book, her excellent book, which I recommend everybody buy immediately. What is Sex? MIT Press 2017. Thanks again.
Thank you very much. I really enjoyed this.
And thanks to our listeners for tuning in. Till next time. Bye-bye.